listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO's end-of-year campaign is happening right now. We invite you to donate and become a member today. We have the full spectrum of ways to join. Go to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Cut through the clouds and make it rain to help us meet our $75,000 goal by December 31st.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, the racial justice editor at Yes Media. This week, acclaimed author and self-proclaimed YP-pologist and columnist for The Griot, Michael Harriott, joins me for a wide-ranging discussion about his new book, Black AF History, The Unwhitewashed Story of America. Then journalist Marjorie Kelly joins me to discuss her new book, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. What happens when a Black analyst and historian applies the same sort of historical and cultural lens to white Americans that whites have viewed Black people through? For example, what if rather than intrepid conquerors, the first white settlers of the United States were more accurately viewed as incompetent thieving cannibals? That's the kind of approach to history that Michael Harriott takes us through in his new book. Michael Harriott is the host of the podcast Drapetomaniacs, Unshackled History, and a columnist at thegriot.com, where he covers the intersection of race, politics, and culture. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, The Atlantic, NBC, BET, and more. He's a political commentator on MSNBC and CNN, and his college course, Race and Economic Construct, was adapted by university economics departments across the country as a model for teaching the combination of history, economics, politics, and class structures. He's the author of the new book, Black AF History, The Unwhitewashed Story of America. I'm so pleased to welcome you to the program, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So first, let me ask you about the background that you describe in your book as really having provided you with the education to be this sort of historian. You were homeschooled and you learned about history, you learned about the world in an environment that was not the same as a traditional school where history is taught through a white supremacist lens, right? And first of all, tell me a little bit about that background and how it has influenced the way you write history.
Yes. So I was homeschooled until I was about 12 years old. And so the way I learned history, one, was largely self-directed, and it wasn't filtered through the lens of whiteness. And I don't think that we appreciate enough how much whiteness has affected the way we learn history, from the Daughters of the Confederacy, who kind of shaped our textbooks throughout school, in schools throughout America, to just the way we approach history with the valorization of the founding fathers, and kind of this mythologizing of America that sometimes is contradictory to the facts. And so I think that played a lot into how I viewed history and how I learned history.
And you have been writing about history and politics for many, many years at The Root and thegriot.com, and you did your podcast. Is this history that you put together in Black AF History, is it something you've been collecting for many years, or did you start from scratch and really say, okay, if I were to write a history about the origins of this nation and its development through today, I would, you know, start it in this way? Is this something you've done over a long period of time, or you did it for the book?
What? I think it was a combination of both. There were some things that I knew I wanted to include, but I mostly started from scratch, consulting with historians, using primary sources to tell the story of America, and not just Black America, but America through the perspective of Black people. So it starts in the 1400s, and we go right up until basically yesterday, telling the story of this country through how Black people see it, which is kind of a different approach than what we usually see, because we'll talk about Black history, right? We'll talk about Black people in America, and then we'll talk about America through the perspective of white people. But rarely do we talk about how Black people view the large history of America. And that's what I wanted to do.
Now, tell me about the way in which you write, particularly about the origins of this nation. I have to say that part of me was cracking up reading your writing, because, of course, it's very funny. You bring your signature comedic sort of sarcasm and scathing humor to the book. But then a lot of it just was also eye-opening. For example, the fact that some of the early settlers, you know, were so incompetent that they just couldn't feed themselves and ended up feeding on themselves.
Right. Like the first people who settled in Jamestown had to resort to cannibalism, and they called it the starving time. And so we have this idea of these people coming to America and building a new country, when largely they were people who were here to make money and steal land, and they weren't used to building things and raising food. And so they largely starved. And we don't tell that story, right? And we don't tell how they attacked the natives. They attacked the natives because the natives wouldn't provide food for them. So when we hear about, you know, this rugged individualism and, you know, rejecting government handouts, that's what the early survivors survived on. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do, is to bring this new perspective. And I think sometimes it's funny, but it's really, you know, embedded in truth. For instance, right? I've always wondered why, for instance, when you go to a social studies class and you'll learn about the French settlers and the English colonizers, or the English colonists and the Dutch settlers, and then all of the Black people are just Africans, and all of the native or indigenous people are just Indians or Native Americans, right? They don't have backstories or religions or histories. And so in my book, right, I use that same template, but reverse it. So all the white people are just white people. Because if you are an African in America, it's not just a French person or a Dutch person, it's just white people to you, right? And so that perspective sometimes lends itself to humor, but it also lends itself to understanding how other people saw and experienced this country throughout its history.
How important, in addition to reversing the lens, how important is also just the language, the verbs and the adjectives that we use? You know, these days, of course, we are, and language evolves all the time. We rarely say, or at least those of us who are forward-thinking progressive people, rarely refer historically to slaves. We talk about enslaved people, and you write, you know, unslaving rather than freeing, someone becoming unslaved as opposed to getting freed. How important is that language in terms of getting us to rethink the origins of this country and its history?
I really think it is important. That's a great question, because nobody's ever asked me that. And it's, as a writer, it's something that I pay attention to all of the time, right? So you're right, I use the term unenslaving instead of freeing, because when you say an enslaved person, it always, you know, there has to be someone who's enslaving, right? When you say a slave, it's just a description of that person's circumstances. One of the examples that I think about often is the idea. So as a journalist, right, one of the first things you learn about when writing is rejecting the passive tense. So the famous example is Michael Harriet was arrested yesterday, right? You're not supposed to write like that. You're supposed to say, the police arrested Michael Harriet, because it gives you more information and it describes something that is happening instead of describing a person's circumstances. But in history, I've always noticed that we use the passive tense to describe Black people. They were enslaved. They were subjected to racism. And the reason they do that is because they don't have to say who did it, right? So if you say white people enslaved them, it's kind of, you know, reactionary. It sounds kind of, it sounds kind of incendiary. But we allow ourselves to reject all of those notions of the language that we typically use to protect whiteness. And I've always thought about that. So that's a really good question.
Now, you write in your book, which is, you know, a story of America, you have a section on the history of Haiti. Why? Haiti is a different country, but you say that it has a very special significance for Black Americans. Why did you include a brief history of Haiti in your book about the history of the United States?
Well, so one of the reasons is because Haiti, and which was the largest successful slave revolt in the history of the world, it impacted America in many ways, right? First of all, the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of this country, was the direct result of a slave revolt in Haiti, right? It gave Africans throughout America this idea, like, if it is possible to revolt and throw off the chains of oppression. And then it really scared white people in America, because, you know, Haiti is, you know, right outside of this country. And so it changed America's diplomacy, right? It changed the way we treated enslaved people, and it really freaked America out. And so it had a very large impact on this country and how we viewed Black people, how we viewed slavery, and how we viewed even this country and its size. Because the Louisiana Purchase, when those enslaved people threw off the chains in Haiti, France basically said, oh, now we're getting out of the slavery business. Y'all want some of this land? And America got the Louisiana Purchase because of a slave revolt.
I want to quote from your book. You write, the Union Army never intended to free the slaves. Lincoln didn't want to free the slaves. The Emancipation Proclamation couldn't free the slaves. Black people freed themselves. And in doing so, they defeated the Confederacy and freed America from its most undemocratic institution. They were less concerned with flags, taxation, or saving the Union than they were with saving their people. This is a very different historical view, or at least a different angle of a history that is so often talked about and referred to whenever we think about racial justice, or whenever we, for that matter, just think about the 4th of July, right? And even white liberals think of Lincoln as having freed the slaves, and the Union Army and the Civil War having been the Revolution having been fought over, rather the Civil War having been fought over freeing the slaves. So tell me a little bit about this very different angle of approaching the seminal, you know, turning point in American history.
So we know that Lincoln never intended to free the enslaved people. He basically said it. If I could save the Union without freeing a single slave, I would. If I could save the Union by freeing all of them, I would. But the South, the Confederate States, attacked the United States to preserve slavery. So the other side wasn't fighting to, you know, free slaves. They were fighting to preserve the Union. And what happened was, just by running away, by freeing themselves, they robbed the Confederacy of all of that economic power that they have. You know, one of the interesting things that a lot of people never think about is the value of all of the enslaved people, because they were technically property, right, was worth more than all of the money in all of the banks in America, plus all of the railroads, plus all of the manufacturing industries in America combined, right? Enslaved people were used as collateral for mortgages. Thomas Jefferson used them for collateral for loans. They were property. And by freeing themselves, by running away, right? Remember that there was a law called, they were technically called contraband when they freed themselves, right? By simply freeing themselves, they hampered the economic power of the South, and they basically helped the Union defeat the South. The enslaved people freed themselves.
I want to talk about how the teaching of history and even the practice of journalism is often viewed through this, or you know, especially white Americans and why journalists and historians like to preserve this idea of objectivity, that we're sort of removed from our personal opinions, are removed from the telling and the retelling of truth and facts. And this notion that history is this unvarnished truth. You take that apart in your book. You point out that it really matters who tells the history. And more importantly, you weave your own family's history and your personal history into the history of the United States. Why is that important? And how does it change the telling of history?
Because I think everyone views every story through a personal lens. And I think just the pretense of objectivity is something that we have believed when it was never true. I remember as a young journalist, I was writing on education, but I had to meet my editor asked me to meet him at the office, and the police came in and gave him the police report about what happened last night. And he basically wrote up the police report as a news story. And I sat there thinking, well, you know, the police always, always, always lie. That's not objective. A police report is not objective. It is the police's side. And it just so happens that the incident that they were talking about, I was there. And it did not happen the way that they described it. And that's always stuck with me, because it's not just the lens and the perspective through which we view events, right? It's also what we choose to include and what we choose to leave out, right? That is a choice that historians and journalists make. They choose whether or not to talk about the perspective of the enslaved people, or the people who were arrested, or the people who suffered the brutality, right? You make every journalist, every writer, every historian makes a choice, right? So the reason, going back to what we talked about earlier, the reason we don't know about the starving time and the incompetence of the people who came to America at the beginning in Jamestown is because they just chose to leave it out. well, why did they choose to leave it out? Because it is a very important story, right? Like when we think about ideas like what was Virginia's largest export? It was iron, because they went to Africa, specifically to the places where Africans had perfected metallurgy and ironworking and blacksmithing, and stole those people and brought them back to America. Well, when you leave that out, you will believe that these founders created a country from scratch just by hard work and ingenuity. When you leave out the fact that America in South Carolina was starving until they realized, oh, these people know how to grow rice, and they went to what they call the Gold Coast or the Rice Coast, and specifically got the people who knew the horticultural and the agricultural engineering to grow rice to create America's first edible cash crop. Then when you leave that out, you believe that it was some kind of hard work and ingenuity that built America, and not the intellectual property and the labor of enslaved people. Even when you talk about slavery, right? We'll talk about the hard work, but we won't talk about the intellectual theft of property that we stole from them, how to grow rice, how to blacksmith. All of that was from the knowledge of enslaved people. The people who came here didn't know how to do that. The enslaved people did. I remember I was writing a story once about the plantation tourism industry in South Carolina. And I was on a plantation that had just survived what they call a 100-year flood. And the people asked, how did they survive it? And it's like, well, the levees and the dams that the enslaved people built 300 years ago, they still work. So we just flooded the plantation when the storm came, and then we opened the levees up and let the water out, and that saved this plantation. That intellectual property is never talked about. We think they just came here and picked cotton and worked hard, and the white people figured out everything else. And leaving that stuff out and choosing what to include is integral in how we understand the origin story of America.
Now, I mentioned earlier that you reverse the lens when you tell your history, but you are also challenging in your book, Black AF History, how Black history is told. I learned so much from your history about the Black women who started the civil rights movement. So Devilish Afire is the name of that chapter. Tell me a little bit about that and why that was important for you, that it wasn't just about showcasing how actually, you know, historic, how actually white settlers and white America is not as lionized as we think it is, but also telling a deeper and more truthful history of the Black freedom fighters and the civil rights warriors.
But I think because, again, when we tell this story, who we choose to leave out, in this case, specifically Black women, is important. Right? Those women like Ella Baker were integral to, they came up with the tactics for the civil rights movement. And when we leave them out, you know, we are led to believe, like Martin Luther King came up one day and said, you know, let's practice nonviolence. And we always leave out the resistance part. So we'll leave out, for instance, that the civil rights movement was not really nonviolent, right? Nonviolent resistance was a tactic they used in protests and demonstrations. But if you came to a Black person's house in the middle of the night and you were the Klan, they were going to let you have that smoke. And we kind of whitewashed nonviolent resistance into nonviolence. And so we're led to believe that the way that America was birthed through a violent revolution, the way that we ended slavery through a violent revolution, the way that we did everything in the history of this country through violence and bloodshed, Black people didn't do that, right? Black people didn't. No, we did that too, right? And it is important to know that that is part of the American tradition, right? And when we leave that part out, it engenders the belief that Black people just sat around and took the abuse, right, you have to fight. And we paint the civil rights picture as these guys who sang songs and held hands, and then white people say, you know what, I think I'll give them their freedom. And that's not really how it worked. It was violent. Oh, the white people were really violent. And even the black people, armed resistance was a very important part of the civil rights movement. And when you tell these stories, you have to include the totality of the story. So there was Martin Luther King, and there were men like Robert F. Williams who believed in armed self-defense. Ida B. Wells believed in armed self-defense. She says, you know, you should not, no black person should have a house without a Winchester rifle over their fireplace, right? W.E.B. Du Bois, all there's stories of like people going to visit Martin Luther King and sitting in a chair is like, oh no, that hard thing you feel is a gun under the cushion. And so this lionized, mythologized version of the civil rights movement is not just like white people's fault, it's the way we tell our history too.
We know a lot also about white culture, and it's not usually referred to as white culture, it's referred to as American culture. And that's another dimension of your book that I really enjoyed, was that you dig into cultural lessons. I loved the section on the difference between soul food and Southern cuisine. Why was that important for you to include in your book? It's a book about history.
I think when you talk about history, we tend to think about it in terms of politics or economics or social movements. But I think the culture, the art, the food we eat, that's part of history too, right? Like, how did what we call American cuisine even come to be, right? Well, we know, like when it comes to fried chicken, there's the history of fried chicken there, right? There's the history of stuff like peach cobbler, right? The history of, again, as we just talked about earlier, rice, all of that stuff, again, I was covering a story years ago, and they were talking about the rice plantations in the South. And a tourist asked, well, how did they learn how to grow rice? Did they bring Asians here? And the woman says, no, the largest large-scale rice plantations in the world were in West Africa, not Asia. And people don't know that. And so it's not just about the social and economic and political history of America, right? I wanted to dig into the culture, right? Rosetta Tharpe, for instance, there's a part about her, one woman is responsible for what we call rock and roll. The guy who invented stand-up comedy, Charlie Case, there's a part of the book about him. And so I wanted to dig into the culture and how what we call American culture is really just black culture, the music, the art, the food, all of that is a modified version that Africans contributed to.
So let's wrap up our conversation. There's so much more I could talk to you about, but I know you have limited time. I want to ask you why you call yourself, on your website, and you've said it elsewhere, you call yourself a YP-pologist. Tell me about that term.
Right. So it goes back to even being homeschooled, right? So I believe that you cannot understand the racial history and white supremacy of this country without by studying black people, because black people didn't create the idea of race. Black people didn't perpetuate it. Black people don't keep it alive. It's white people that do that. So to understand it, you have to be intentional about looking into and examining the history and the cultural and the cultural mores of white people. And so thus white peopleologists, right? Because black people aren't largely responsible for how we understand race in this country. White people perpetuated, they created it out of scratch, and they used it as a tool to ensure their supremacy. And so to understand that, you're going to have to examine the economics and political history of white people. And so that's, I think I use it as a joke, but it really is embedded in a truth that white people created the racial dynamics that are used, that are unique to America.
And then we have this history, backlash against history, right, you know, of course, coming just as the history being taught in schools is starting now to become more accurate, which suggests that there's such power in a more accurate and nuanced telling of history. That more accurate history teaching is important for young white kids to learn about their, the true history of their country. But it seems as though it is also critically important for Black kids, for kids of color, to learn about the history as, say, you tell it and historians like you tell it. Because to me, it seems as though it instills a sense of confidence and a rejection of the otherizing that children of color feel. And I got that from reading your book. Can you expand on that a little bit, or do you even agree with my sentiments here?
Yeah, I do. I do think it is important. Again, if we go back to what we talked about earlier, if you're a little a Black child in a social studies class in the fourth grade, right, and your white classmates, they have a history, right? Their families were Protestants who came over here to escape religious persecution, or they were Quakers, or they were not aristocrats and they came over here for political freedom. And then all of the Africans, they were just slaves, right? They don't have a history, they didn't have a religion, they didn't have a culture. You don't know your background, you're just an enslaved person. Well, I think what that does is makes you believe that all the things that you have were given to you by white people, right? Because you didn't have anything, like you don't have a culture or a history until white people gave it to you. You were just an amorphous being. Well, the truth is, and this is really the point of the book, think about the Africans who first arrived in America. They didn't have a language or a family or belongings or possessions. They couldn't even speak the language. And in just a very short period of time, in historically wise, right? A blink of an eye, really. Look where we are. We created institutions. We freed ourselves. We taught ourselves to read, we were educated, we built every communities, we built businesses, and it was just a very short period of time from where we had nothing to where we are basically threatening the white supremacy of America. And if you think about that, right, think about how short of a time we did it in and how remarkable it is that we had nothing and now look at us now, then you, knowing that history, it will give you a sense of pride. It will give you a sense of belonging because you know the food that they eat, you taught them how to cook it. The dances they do, you taught them how to do them. The music you hear, that came from your culture, the religion that they believe in, you contributed to that. All of it is part of your history. Their history is part of your history. And knowing that is empowering. And it places you not as an outsider, but a contributor to the American project. And I think that is why this is important.
I love that. As an immigrant, that's something that I've always taken pride in. But I also know that Black Americans have had that historical context stripped away, up until more recently, and especially with contributions from historians like yourself. And that, you know, is changing the nature of this country, which, of course, is also generating the white supremacist backlash. And we could probably talk about that for hours. Michael Harriott, such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. What are all the places that people can find out about the work you do? Is there a website?
Thegriot.com. I'm writing on there every day. And All of my social media is Michael Harriott, MichaelHarriott. Of course, the podcast, Draptomaniacs, and everywhere, like just Google and you'll find it.
Will do.
But yeah, it's not hard to find.
Thank you again. Good luck with the book, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Michael Harriott. He's host of the podcast Draptomaniacs, Unshackled History, and he's also a columnist at thegriot.com and done lots and lots of other things, which, as he said, you can Google. We've been discussing his new book, which is called Black AF History, The Unwhitewashed Story of America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The U.S. economic system is facing increasing scrutiny for the wealth inequality it has generated, and that continues to worsen. A significant part of the stranglehold that our current form of capitalism has is simply cultural. The idea that when stock prices are booming and the Dow Jones is high, the economy is healthy, and therefore ordinary Americans are thriving. But applying a clarifying lens to the prevailing economic model reveals that we live under a system of what my guest calls wealth supremacy. Marjorie Kelly is a distinguished fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. She's a leading theorist in democratic economy design, and she joins me to discuss her latest book, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. Welcome to the program, Marjorie.
Thanks, Sonali. I'm glad to be here.
So first, how do we define wealth supremacy? You know, I'm the racial justice editor at Yes Magazine, and so I talk often about white supremacy. Right. What is wealth supremacy? Is there an analogy? And is there even overlap with white supremacy?
Yes, there's definitely an analogy and an overlap. And it was deliberate when I chose this title, because I'm trying to show how similar they are. So wealth supremacy is the idea that wealthy people matter more than the rest of us. They deserve more power, they deserve more comfort, more prosperity, and that's normal, and that's the way things should be. It's very similar to white supremacy. It's kind of the norms of society that can fall to the background and can seem acceptable until you point out that this is really bias. And that it's not legitimate. So that's what I'm trying to do here, is to say this really is a biased system. If you suspect that it's rigged against you, it is, and I show how. Yes, and the two do overlap a lot. I think people of color understand instinctively and intuitively that property of ownership is a concept that is can be weaponized and can be used against people. And that's a lot what's happening in this system of wealth supremacy.
Is it just cultural, or is it also built into the system? Well, let's talk about the systemic nature in which how our economic system is designed to privilege the wealthy. You know, I think many of us do know that. Even white people understand from a very instinctive level that the wealthier you are, the more loopholes you have, the more benefits you get through our tax system, through our, you know, through the economic models that the government has adopted, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. Look at the 2008 meltdown, for example. Predatory mortgages from the big banks, and there was a big institutional investors and wealthy investors who supported this, you know, came in and basically took the equity out of people's homes through predatory mortgages. It was mostly or often people of color who lost their homes, who were pushed into predatory mortgages when they could have qualified for regular mortgages. So that there we see racial inequity happening, but it's happening hand in hand with what I call capital bias or wealth supremacy. So, you know, these big banks, these big institutional investors, you know, if they can make money on racism, they will, but they aren't necessarily even aware of the racism involved. They just want the maximum returns. So yes, the two are entirely entwined.
So the economy is rigged. If you're wealthy, the more wealth you have, the more wealth you can make. Billionaires know right. this. Even those very, very few billionaires who try to give away their wealth end up accruing wealth faster than they can give it away, just because of the way the system is set up. And that's quite remarkable, right? And I'm wondering if you can sure. also explain how our system has become perverted away yeah. from the sort of real nuts and bolts idea of what we think of as wealth. A home to most of us is wealth, but that's not how right, our system right. really defines it, right?
Yeah, so let's talk for a second, Sonali, about how the system is rigged. So what I do in my book, Wealth Supremacy, is I look at seven myths, which really form the operating system of capitalism. And the first one is no amount of wealth is ever enough. That is the prime, it's the primary principle built into investing. You know, Bill Gates, at one point, the founder of Microsoft, at one point, he had $10 billion. That's, you could fund 100 dynasties that would last for generations with that. But what did he do? He invested, and two decades later, he had $300 billion. And so no amount of wealth is ever enough. You keep investing, you keep wanting more. That's one myth. Another is that workers are not members of the corporation. And this is how corporate governance is designed. It's only capital that has a vote inside the corporation. The board of directors is elected by capital. And the more wealth you have, the more votes you have. So right there, you see how capital is empowered, whereas if labor wants to be empowered, they have to go out and organize shop by shop by shop. And a place like Starbucks will have 1,800 shops, and so you have to organize 1,800 shops, whereas capitalism is empowered automatically without a single fight required. So those are a couple of examples of how the myths that the system operates by and how it's rigged. And so you said how has it gotten so out of whack? Well, I grew up in a family. My father ran a small business. My grandfather had a slightly larger business. We were never wealthy, but we had enough money. We lived on one salary. I was able to go to college without a lot of debt. And my mother was able to retire without having to work outside the home. There was no dynasty, there was no, you know, huge transfer of intergenerational wealth, but there was some cushion and some prosperity. That is not how, that's how the system used to work, how it's supposed to work, and it doesn't anymore. I mean, even the middle class doesn't have assets. You have 2 out of 3 Americans lack even $1,000 to fall back on. I mean, Sonali, you and I could think of a million ways that you need $1,000. Your car breaks down, you have a kid who needs a band uniform, you know, maybe you want to take a little vacation or something. I mean, $1,000 is nothing. And yet people don't, 2 out of 3 don't even have that. Meanwhile, not only has the number of billionaires grown, which, you know, we hear about that a lot. But one of the things I look at in the book is how aggregate financial wealth has grown. So if you take all financial assets, stocks and bonds and debts of various kind, and you think of that as a sphere. So that used to be equal, to GDP, which is gross domestic product, and that's like income and spending. So that's the real economy. People, you know, work jobs, they get money, they spend their money. That's the GDP. But meanwhile, there's the sphere of financial assets, which is now five times GDP. And it grows by extraction. It keeps it wanting to extract more and more and get bigger and bigger and bigger, because as we said, no amount of wealth is ever enough. And so in the aggregate, what we have now is a financialized capitalism. It's a new kind of capitalism. It's not about robber barons. It's not even about CEOs. It's about capital. And capital is on autopilot and trying to grow and get bigger. And it's become a destructive force, capturing government. Dark money is funding some of this hard right insanity that's happening. You have, you know, ExxonMobil won't stop producing fossil fuels because it feels it has an obligation to its shareholders, and so on. So there are all kinds of forms of real devastation that are happening. Families loaded with debt, workers who their jobs have been turned into contingent, part-time, insecure jobs. 40% of jobs are now insecure and contingent in that way. And so all of this devastation is happening while these wealthy portfolios expand and expand and expand. And it's reached a point of real trouble and absurdity.
I want to get to the designing alternative models part of it and what you mean by a democratic economy. But just picking up on what you were talking about, this idea of fiduciary responsibility, and it's something that you yes. write about. Tell me more about that. It's not something that we think about unless we're economists, we think about. But the fact that it is such a sort of considered a sacrosanct thing in our economy is a huge reason why we have a climate crisis and so much poverty and inequality, right?
It's really true. I thank you for pointing that one out. That's another of the myths that I point to. And a fiduciary duty, boy, you know, it sounds so benign. It sounds so technical. You know, you just want to, you know, yawn. It's so boring. And fiduciary duty, what it means is, let's say that you or I has a little bit of assets, and so we turn it over to a mutual fund or an investment advisor. Well, that fund or advisor has an obligation to act in our behalf, right? That manager can't run off and invest the money in their crazy Uncle Harry, or they can't take the money and spend it on their own vacation in the Bahamas. You know, they have a fiduciary duty to take care of their client and act like it's their client's money and not their own. Well, that's fine and that's necessary and that's good. We all want that. It's pretty necessary and benign. But there's this other thing that's tucked inside fiduciary duty, and it's what I call capital bias. And it's this idea that only capital matters, which is another word for wealth, and nothing else matters. So if you're going out and trying to return good returns to your investor, if you trash the environment, if you devastate society, if you ruin the lives of tens of thousands of laborers, doesn't matter. It's not material. The only thing that matters is maximizing those gains for capital. So that capital bias that's tucked into fiduciary duty, that's the danger. And we don't see it because we're taught, oh, well, of course you have to, you know, be responsible in how you manage investments. Well, of course you do. But you don't have to pretend that nothing else in the world matters. And that's the problem.
So we have a constitution that determines and tells us that all people are created equal, and yet we have an economic system that says, no, if you're wealthy, then you matter more. How do we redesign our economic system yeah. to actually adhere to the tenets of a liberal democracy?
Yeah, so a society half democratic and half plutocratic is not going to endure. And that's what we have right now. So one side or the other is going to take over, right? Either we're going to have plutocrats taking over the government, hamstringing politicians with, you know, political donations and lobbying by corporations, We're going to stop our ability to deal with climate change because ExxonMobil won't like it. So you can have plutocracy take over, and that's what happens in financialization. Or you can have democracy be suffused throughout society. So we have a democratic government and we have a democratic economy. That's what we're working for, the democracy collaborative. And I have been tracking this as a journalist and a theorist and a consultant for really three decades now, Sonali. And I've written for Yes Magazine. Yes Magazine is one of the wonderful outlets that is promoting a democratic economy in various models. So what does it mean? So we have an extractive economy, which we have now, or you have a democratic economy, right? So an extractive economy is designed to extract maximum wealth for the few. It's about extracting financial wealth. Well, a democratic economy is designed to serve all of us and to help us all prosper and have lives of dignity and freedom, and to have a living earth, a sustainable earth, because, of course, you can't have lives of dignity and meaning when ecological devastation is all around us. So how do you design that? Well, first of all, it's about what do we care about? Social institutions are really designed around our values, right? Democracy is about, you know, liberty and equality and justice. Well, a democratic economy is about those things. It's also about fairness. It's about sustainability. It's about community. And people instinctively care about these values. These are things that we care about. And so how do you design for community? Well, for example, the community should own its own water. It should own electricity. And there are 85% of Americans who right now, we get our water from municipally owned utilities, city owned, county owned. This is government ownership, right? We're taught to fear government ownership as though it's communism. But that's absurd. That's just red baiting. You want public ownership of essential assets like water. Meanwhile, big capital is out there trying to buy water rights in Colorado and California. I open my book, Wealth Supremacy, with that very scary story. We're coming into a world of water shortages. And so who's going to be in control of water? Is it going to be big capital trying to make a ton of money on it? Or is it going to be communities who see water as a human right and that we all need to have access to water every single day? Every living creature does, not just humans. And so this is one of the big battlegrounds ahead is water. Electricity, there are municipally owned and cooperatively owned electricity in our country. And it's shown that there are lower rates and better service when it's owned cooperatively or by the community. 15% of forests worldwide are now controlled by indigenous communities or by community groups. And the UN has said that this model is vital to preserving ecological biodiversity. So you can have worker ownership of firms. There's 6,000 substantially worker-owned firms, including Recology in the Bay Area, which is a $1 billion company. And it's 100% owned by its workers. It serves communities up and down the West Coast. It has a mission of a world without waste. And it pays garbage truck drivers $100,000 a year, because if you're not extracting a lot of wealth for shareholders, there's more to go around for workers. Worker ownership. So you can also have community land trusts, which keep housing affordable. So there's state-owned banks, community-rooted banks. So there's a variety of models. They have the public good at their core, and they have broad-based ownership, either workers, or you have farmer-owned cooperatives, or community-owned solar and water, and so on. So you want broad-based ownership, the public good at the core, and we need a great ownership transition. That's one great process that we need toward a democratic economy. And another is we need new forms of capital as well.
So it's not as though there's some never before thought of idea on how to make our economy more democratic. There's models that already exist, and it's a matter of changing the priorities and the systemic built-in biases of our economy. So to that end, how do we change our culture to help Americans be on board with this? First of all, reject the current system and then be on board with redesigning the system. That it feels like we need a class consciousness that the US unfortunately doesn't have, because we tend to all be aspirational billionaires, right? Or many of us think that we're just billionaires in waiting.
Yeah, you're right. I love what you said, that these models exist, they've been proven. It's not as though, I'm talking about some pie in the sky thing. And so we need a change of consciousness. One of the things I talk about in my book, Wealth Supremacy, is where do we start? How can we participate in this system change, really, is what we're talking about. And I say that the first thing we need to do is to talk to each other. Right? We need to read my book, read other books, read about these various models and get a little bit educated, talk to each other so that we give each other permission to think this way. The mainstream media isn't as much help as it should be. I mean, of course, you hope that this concept of wealth supremacy will catch on and people will, that language maybe will help, or the democratic economy, that concept can help. But, I think back, Sonali, to the 70s and second wave feminism. And where do you start? Women were at their kitchen tables talking to each other, about their unease and about something didn't seem right, and recognizing that sexism was real, that male supremacy was real. People of color have helped us as a culture to understand that white supremacy is real. And so we need a similar kind of, almost like a kitchen table movement to say wealth supremacy is real. This is not hand waving. This is not ideological arguing. It's a real force in our society, and we need to see it. It's a force as big as climate change, and yet much more invisible. And I think once we see it, we'll be motivated to act. That's my hope.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Marjorie. Is there a website that you can share where people can find out more about the work you do?
Sure. Yes. I'm going to mention too, go to wealthsupremacy.org, and you'll see different things I've written there and learned about the book. And you can also go to democracycollaborative.org and learn about the organization where I work that's working to build a democratic economy.
Wonderful. We'll post links to both of those from our site. Thank you so much, Marjorie.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Marjorie Kelly, a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. We've been discussing her new book, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. And by the way, you're probably aware that Rising Up with Sonali has recently joined forces with Yes Media. But for those of you who are unfamiliar, Yes Media is an independent solutions journalism nonprofit. We take no money from corporations, which means that a lot of our funding comes from donations from viewers and listeners like you. To be frank, we need more donations and we need to fundraise specifically $350,000 before the end of the year. If you donate right now or become a monthly donor, any gift you make before December 31st will be doubled by a generous donor who really wants Yes to continue making an impact in the upcoming year and beyond. So if you can, please head to yesmagazine.org/donate to make a donation.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual end-of-year campaign. You can help us meet our $75,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $20,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. Thanks so much for your support.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio.